All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, Nicks? What the fucksters? What's happening? I just switched it up. Did you notice? I switched it up to what the fuck things. Trying to keep it fresh. I'm exhausted. I'm fucking exhausted. I was in and out of sleep all last night. Had some weird dream that involved Jeff Sessions. I don't know what the dream was, but I heard a voice in my left ear, and I've only heard that one other time. That clearly, as if it was waking me up, it sounded like this. Crime. Crime. And the only other time I heard that voice was when I was strung out on cocaine in Los Angeles, having a psychotic meltdown, hearing voices in my head, and in the same ear, a voice said, get out. How far out can I go? I asked it. You've gone far enough. Crime. So what does that mean? How you doing? You all right? How was your night? Crime. Dennis Quaid is on the show. Yes, that Dennis Quaid that we all sort of grew up with, and he's grown up with us. I've been seeing him on screen since Breaking Away. He's here. I was excited to talk to him because he's one of those guys where, oddly, I've seen a lot of his fucking movies, and he's got a new movie out. It's a, I don't know if you call it a thriller or a horror movie, but I watched it, and it was pretty scary. The new movie's called The Intruder. It's in theaters now, and he's also in a very different film where he doesn't play a psychopath, A Dog's Journey. Watch The Range of Dennis Quaid. So that's coming up. I'm talking to Dennis Quaid. So let's read some emails, because that's always fun. Let's lighten it up. Subject line, ha, 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 fart talk. Welcome to Morning Radio. Mark. This could not have been more appropriately timed. I'm about to pick up my college-aged daughter, who is proudly the owner of the nastiest gas. As a mother, I'm constantly reminded that this younger generation doesn't have the same hang-ups as ours, and this is such a funny example. Thanks for the laugh. I'm going to replay the intro just for her. Angie, you matter. I'm so glad that I'm bringing parents together with their kids. They're going to have a good laugh. Maybe both of them will start farting in the car, and don't get into an accident. This was fun. Subject line, interviewing older ladies, country music. Have listened for 9 years. Look forward to Mondays and Thursdays because of that. Two things. One, when you interview older women, e.g. Sissy Spacek, Jane Fonda, you interject a ton more yes, uh-huhs, or just general grunts while they're talking. I'm guessing it relates to your impatience when talking with your mom. It's obnoxious. Please cut it out. Two, this is where he tries to save it. Merle Haggard's If I Could Only Fly album, Simple and Beautiful, maybe give it a listen. Like he thinks he's going to slide that in with me. Like, I'm going to attack your style. And then like, but we're still buddies, right? Thanks for what you do, Scott. So I wrote back, I think if you listen, I do that with everyone. Sounds like your issue, maybe with your mom. Yeah, I went ahead and hit send on that one. I hit send. You know how they say take a pause? No pause. Boom. He wrote back, you never know what's going to happen. That could open up a portal to someone's innards that could go on for paragraphs. But nope, Scott, just hit me right back. Well played. You damn fucking right it was, Scott. I went and saw a play, that's a P-L-A-Y, I know I say it like pray, play. I went and saw a play last night called The Wolves here at the Echo Theater Company in Los Angeles. I don't generally go to theater in Los Angeles, but I did. This is about I think it's a young, it's not, I don't know if they're young, they're teenagers, right? Teenagers, soccer team. And it all takes place on the field over the course of several different matches with some interstitial stuff, some blackouts, some interesting moments with the actresses. But I didn't know what to expect. It was a little theater. There's no intermission. Now, as an older gentleman, you do worry about the pee problem. You know, it's like, I guess I'm at an age now where I'm like, oh, should I have drunk that soda? Like, how much of my night is going to be ruined because I can't go pee? I almost peed in my car the other day. I'm not proud of it. It happened in England, and it happened here. Did I tell you about that? Did I tell you about what happened in San Diego with the pee thing? I got to be honest with you. Sometimes there are moments in life where you realize I'm not afraid. I have courage. I'm not going to take any shit. I don't have to take any shit. I was driving to San Diego and it was getting dicey and there was nowhere to get off. There was traffic heading in and I'm holding in pee. This is not, I don't think there's a physiological problem. I just had to pee and I was in a car and there was nowhere to go and there was traffic. So I'm like, and I'm gunning it to where the hotel is. I don't know exactly which hotel I'm at yet. And I just park in front of this one. And it wasn't the hotel I was staying at. And I walk in because I figure I can get away with this. It's a lobby situation. Where's the men's room? And they're like, you got to use the one in the restaurant next door. So I go through and it's connected to the hotel lobby. I open the door. The restaurant's not quite open yet. And they're setting up. The waiter's there. And I go, dude, where's the men's room? And he's like, hey, it's only for customers. And I looked at him. And I said, I'm fucking going. And he saw it in my eye. He saw it. I'd like to think he was afraid of my power, but I just think he was like, this old guy's in trouble and I'm not going to step in here. So I went and I peed and I got out and I went to hand him a few bucks. I'm like, here, take it, man. Take it. If that's your trip, man, if whatever you just did there, if that's the extent of your power, it's for customers only. Why do you think, do you think I want to be in this situation? I'm a grown ass fucking man. Do you think I want to be like, you know, at the point I'm at now with you? It's for customers only. Here's a couple bucks, buddy. You know what I mean? Thanks for not getting in my way. Cause you could have stiff armed me. You could have tackled me. No, it's for customers only. And I'm like, it's too late now. You feel that wetness on your leg? That's because I'm peeing in my pants. And you're on top of me holding me down. Who wins here? Let's take a couple bucks, buddy. You want to take a couple bucks? No, man, you don't have to do that. All right, I'm just trying to, you know, thank you. Could have gotten ugly. What was I talking about? So I go to this theater thing. It was great. It was moving. Like, I didn't know where it was going to go. It was, it's one of those plays where it's sort of like, is this the way it's going to be? This whole, you know, 6 to 8 women, you know, talking like they're kicking around a soccer ball or however many. What I don't know. They're talking about things that teenage girls talk about, but they're also talking about genocide and they're talking about periods and they're talking about boys. But it all just evolves in a very subtle way. And it all takes place around, you know, kicking around a soccer ball, waiting to play. And it just evolves into this thing that becomes very deep and very moving. And it was beautifully performed by all the performers. And there's a twist at the end where it just kind of fucks you right in the head and right in the guts and you're crying. And it was really tremendous. And look, I just wanted to give you a heads up because it closes today. So, but it was good. It was good. So if you want to tell your friends about it, you can tell them that I said it was good. Wow. Am I napping? I feel like I just took a nap. Was I awake through that? This is all a dream. Did you hear a guy say crime right in your ear? Crime. Are we all dreaming? Nope. Hey, I'm going to talk to Dennis Quaid. This has been a stream of consciousness shit show. I hope you enjoyed it. Dennis Quaid is an actor. You might know him from many movies. The Rookie, The Right Stuff, Breaking Away, The Big Easy, The Long Riders. Remember that one where all the brothers were in it? The Quaid brothers, the Carradine brothers. Christopher Guest has a brother. They brought him in. Walter Hill movie. I'll ask him about that. The new movie is The Intruder. It's in theaters now, and he's also in a very different type of film, A Dog's Journey, which opens on May 17th. This is me and Dennis Quaid. He brought his dog. He brought his bulldog. That's the first time a guy shows up at my house with his dog. He's like, is that okay? I'm like, not really. I've got 3 cats in the house. I don't see how this is going to work out. He's like, can we leave him somewhere? Leave her somewhere? I'm like, I don't know. And then I realized that my yard is actually enclosed and I could have a dog if I want. And we put his dog out there and it worked out. It was a bulldog, kind of a small, mid-sized bulldog. I guess they come in sizes, bulldogs. You can order small, medium, or large. His was a medium-sized bulldog. I think it was called that. What kind of dog is that? It's a medium bulldog. You can get it in small, medium, large, extra large. And those are the ones that they can barely walk because they're hobbled. And like, isn't it adorable? I don't know. It looks crippled. Is that adorable? Anyway, this is me and Dennis Quaid. It's a little odd to walk people up into the house, you know, past the bedroom, and, you know, there's...
It's what it is, man.
Yeah, it's the future of entertainment.
That's right.
Well,
so
how it's do you, the now of entertainment.
The now, yeah. Did you, have you done some other home-based podcasts?
Well, I'm actually executive producing and narrating a podcast with T-Bone Burnett and Bob Dylan and...
I just had T-Bone over here.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jared Goodstadt.
Jared Goodstadt?
Yeah.
Who's that?
Jingle Jared. Have you ever heard of him?
No, wait. But you're going to do it with Bob and T-Bone?
Well, Bob is contributing a song. And,
oh, okay.
Pooh Bear. Do you know who Pooh Bear is?
No, who's that?
Musician.
I feel like I should know
he's
him.
He's mostly a writer-producer these days. He did the American version of it, like Despacito, and he has a couple of other real hit songs that, you know, with Justin Bieber.
Oh, okay.
A lot of them. Produces his records, stuff like that.
So, like, T-Bone, he was one of the last guys out in the garage before I had to do the construction.
Yeah.
But his ex-wife, it's not Sam, is it?
Yes, it is. Oh. Yeah, Sam Phillips.
Sam Phillips lives around the corner. I just ran into her husband.
No kidding.
I ran into her husband yesterday. He introduced himself to me.
Really?
And she grew up here, so he like knew the neighborhood.
Oh,
and
that's
like,
incredible. His daughter lives over here then,
I guess
too?
So.
Yeah, they had a daughter together. I think she's about like 1920, something like that.
All your kids are getting older.
Yeah, no kidding.
But you have young kids too, don't you?
I have 11-year-olds and 27-year-old. But T-Bone and I go back for 42, 43 years.
Isn't
when
that
I first
wild?
Came out to L.A., he was one of the first people I met.
Really?
Yeah. He was helping my brother to audition for the Buddy Holly story.
For the lead?
Yeah, for Buddy Holly. And then later on, I married, my first wife was PJ Souls, who used to be married to Stephen Souls, who was in the Alpha Band with T-Bone.
Oh,
they were the backup band for Dylan at the time.
For Rolling Thunder.
The Alpha Band, and the Rolling Thunder Review.
Yeah.
So we used to go to a lot of Dylan concerts, and then T-Bone was the producer of Great Balls of Fire music.
He did that whole movie.
Yeah.
Where you played Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yes.
Did you have to deal with Jerry Lee Lewis?
On a daily basis. Now, you're recording, by the way? I hope
sure.
so.
Oh,
yeah, good.
Yeah, I mean, like, what year was that? I mean, I can check if you don't remember.
That was 1986 or 7, I think.
And that's why I remember that movie. It's a good movie. And it's a tough role to play because he's a deep, dark well.
Yes.
And, and like, but there's also the pop star side of it.
Yeah. And, you know, the beginnings of rock and roll. And, you know, the movie was done to be like a summer release movie, you know?
Yeah.
But then if you really start thinking about it, and they kind of made it into, you know, very kind of pop music, very accessible type of thing, and stayed away from most of the dark stuff.
Yeah.
But
that's
if you really
remember,
think about it, you know, you're going to drop your kids off at the theater to go see a story about a 21-year-old guy marrying a 12-year-old girl.
Right. Yeah. In the Southern way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's kind of a tough ask, I think. But the film, you know, looking back at it now, it's kind of a infectious. It grows on you.
Sure. I was sort of fascinated with him and the fact that he's still alive and he's still making records. And like some of those guys, like there's collections that like they never stop recording. There's hundreds of recordings. I don't know where they found the time.
Right. Well, they always find the time. You know, musicians, you know, when you're at that, they're always recording.
Right.
They'd rather record than go on tour.
So they're just in the studio hanging around.
In the studio, just whatever comes to mind, they'll go in and cover songs. They'll go in. I mean, these days it's very collegial. Everybody's working with everybody else and getting in.
It's easier
just
too.
Like social media. They're getting in on each other's social media. They invite somebody who's up and coming, or you invite an old established guy to into your song.
Sure.
To, you know, give you street cred or whatever.
Right, and it's also easier without the without tape.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Like, oh, everybody's got a studio just like you in their house.
Yeah, and it's you can do good quality shit.
Right.
So when you, okay, so like you've only done that a couple of times, I guess, where you actually play a real person.
No, a whole bunch of times.
Really?
Yeah, like, I'd say maybe a quarter of my roles have been real people.
Is that true? Like,
it seems like it.
I mean, I know, like,
I played Gordo Cooper, and I played Doc Holliday. I played Jimmy Morris, the pitcher and the rookie.
Oh, that was a real guy. But yeah. Doc Holliday, you can't hang out with. I mean, you could hang out with Gordo, yes. Right? And you could hang out with Jerry Lee Lewis, right?
Yes.
But when you're hanging out with Jerry Lee Lewis, what I mean, he must have been a pain in the ass on some level. Not in a bad way.
Yeah, I'll say this because, you know, it almost seemed that there was a little bit of the 14-year-old bully schoolyard in there.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But that's him. He has, you know, a learned sort of... I won't call it suspicion, but
right.
You know, he kind of checks people out.
Yeah, yeah.
And but he's also just a very generous human being. He was one of my piano teachers. Yeah, and we did a video together. I have such respect for him.
Did he teach you how to play like Jerry Lee Lewis?
A little bit. It's all about the left hand.
Right.
But he was also on the set every day. He was over my shoulder going, "You get it wrong, son."
Yeah, that sounds about right. So it's weird when I got to interview a guy who I feel like I grew up with, you know, in the sense that, like, you're very familiar to me, you know, from all the roles going back to, like, you know, Breaking Away. And then, like, you're just always sort of there. You've always been there.
Yeah.
You know? And now, like, it's these insurance company commercials.
Insurance?
Yeah, they're kind of funny.
They're surprisingly painless, aren't they?
They are. Well, I like the sort of inside idea of it.
Yeah.
You know, like you're trying to, like, show...
Lift the veil to be transparent.
Yeah. But the weird thing is, like, in a time where, you know, I don't think a lot of people are watching a lot of television, you're, like, all over the place. Like, you know, like, you're all of a sudden this familiar presence to everybody on a very immediate level, you know, every day.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, finally, at the end of the day, there's someone from just about every generation at... It's kind of transgenerational for a different movie. You know, it could be Dragonheart or it could be Dreamscape going further back, you know, for the Snake. Then I have my Parent Trap kids.
Yeah.
The Rookie, you know, is another one. And
in The Company, what was that other one? The Good Company.
Good Company.
I love that movie.
Yeah, but the certain generations that were kids when they saw the film, and kids grow up.
Right, yeah. So and
get them as kids, you got them.
Yeah, right, and they remember you forever.
Kids have better memories than adults.
Right, and it sticks in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, where do you come from originally?
I come from Houston, Texas.
Really?
Yeah, first 20 years in Houston, yeah.
So your family's, like, Texan.
Yeah, or Houston is sometimes referred to as West Louisiana.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
there's a lot of Louisiana people there, that's for sure.
And are they from Louisiana, your people?
Well, going way back with that, but my dad was from Oklahoma. He grew up in Oklahoma the first 5 years of his life. In fact,
cowboys, oil,
more reservation type. And my cousin is Gene Autry.
Really?
Third cousin. Yeah, he was my grandfather's first cousin.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So he's the singing cowboy, right?
Yes, that's right. He was also on the Angels. And KTLA.
Uh-huh.
He's probably, I would say Gene Autry, you know, dollar for dollar, you could make a case that he was probably the richest man in show business all time. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Right.
Okay. Just that. And it's Frosty the Snowman.
He wrote Frosty the Snowman?
Yes, along with a couple of things. And then he had a very successful career as a singing cowboy. And then he bought KTLA Channel 5 here in Los Angeles, and that was back in the day of early television when there was no east-west coast hookup.
Sure.
And so Channel 5 broadcast to the entire western United States.
Yeah.
It was, like, basically a network.
Right.
It was huge. And of course, he owned all the land, too, that went under it. He bought a bunch of land at Anaheim, and he built, you know, that's the Angels played there, and he owned that.
No kidding.
So if you take it for dollar, the guy.
Did you meet the guy?
I finally met him in the opening of Wyatt Earp. He came to that.
How old was he?
By that time, I think he was in his 90s, maybe. He lived a very long time.
Yeah.
Great great human being.
And it was your grandfather's first cousin.
Yeah.
That's wild. And you're, and they're from Oklahoma, but then you have people from Louisiana and then people from Texas.
Yeah, basically.
And like, what was the family's business?
My dad was an electrical contractor and, you know, had his own business.
Yeah.
He was also a frustrated actor. And he was crooning around the house all the time. His Elvis was Bing Crosby.
Oh, really?
And, you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra.
But he never really, he didn't actually perform. He didn't, like, he wasn't a guy that.
Yeah, he would go down to, you know, the piano bars.
Oh, he
like
would?
He used to, yeah, he loved to do that. He was always doing routines.
Yeah.
He introduced my brother and I to acting, really, you know, by pointing out actors on television and Laurel and Hardy and all those bits, you know, and that's probably where we got the bite.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah, you think?
And
what's the age difference between you guys?
3.5 years.
It's not that much.
Yeah. Then my mom's from East Texas,
which means
well, that would be very country.
Yeah.
East Texas. My grandfather.
Yeah.
Came to Texas in 1901 in a covered wagon.
Really?
From Tennessee. Yeah.
From the South.
Yeah.
So it's like it's all right across.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was he doing? What did he do?
Well, he was
set up shop.
He basically kind of scraped all his life. He was a roughneck on oil wells.
Yeah.
And which is a very tough job.
Sure.
You know, because his wife had died, my mom's mom, and you know he had to scrape it together with the kids. And he was a cotton farmer for a while. He was a tent preacher for a while. Sold Bibles door to door.
Isn't that weird that
his
like,
last job was a guard in an Austin insane asylum.
Huh.
And then his second wife's father died and left those kids some land, and he hocked his Buick, and he used to be, you know, a roughneck on oil rigs.
Yeah.
And he knew what was around. And
it was,
you know, during the late 50s.
Yeah.
And what do you know? They struck oil, of course, and he went to being worth, you know, zero to like $2 million, just that.
Just because his wife's kids inherited the land, and
yeah.
He was like, let's take a look under there.
There's got
to be something under there.
Well, they wanted to sell it, so he bought the oil rights to it.
That's a good story.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that there was a time where people could just decide to be preachers. It didn't require
any
training.
Well, you could still do that. In fact, even more than ever now with social media and podcasts, you could decide to be a preacher.
But you could make a go at it. You could make a living if you were entertaining enough.
Right.
That it was really a performance trip, right?
Yes, and you can even call yourself doctor.
Yeah. Was he a doctor?
No.
No, he didn't.
No,
do
he was not.
So you guys are, I just, like, Texas, I grew up in New Mexico. But it's definitely not Texas. And I like Houston. Like, Houston's become kind of a weird, eclectic city. It's very spread out.
Yeah, it always has been, though.
Really?
Yeah, really. You know, it's always had that Cowtown stamp on it or whatever.
Right.
But it always has been a very, it was a great town to grow in for music.
Oh, yeah?
You had all kinds, you know, it was a big city. So you got a lot of different kinds of music, different influences.
And music's important
because
here.
Because
you play, right?
It's in the East Texas.
Yeah.
And so you get that Texas rock and roll and that and the western swing thing, and then Louisiana invites the Cajun influence, and then it's cosmopolitan. So, my dad was singing Bing Crosby and Dean Martin,
but also you get some of that conjunto music, the accordion Mexican music.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was a great place to grow in for music. It was like a music gumbo down there.
And you're a guitar player?
Yes.
And did that start before the acting?
Of course. Yes, it did. When I was about 12, my grandfather actually bought me my first guitar. It was like a $12 guitar from Western Auto.
Oh, from Western Auto?
With nylon strings. And I tried to learn Light My Fire. That was the first one? To try to learn it.
Yeah.
That's
not too tough.
And actually, if you're first learning, that's not a great one to.
Those are kind of rough chords.
You have some bar chords
that you have
to hit there, and you don't have the muscles for that.
So were you were you in rock bands?
We called them combos back in the '60s. You know, like from seventh grade, I had.
You're in a combo.
Yeah, it was a way of getting girls. You know,
that's what a lot of people say.
Because it wasn't, you know, I wasn't big enough to be in on the football team or
right.
anything like
that. Oh, really?
That. And that's how I wound up in the drama room, basically.
But what about, so your brother, was he also in the music?
He was more into stand-up comedy.
Really?
As a kid, kind of growing up. And in fact, had a really great, with Trey Wilson. Do you remember Trey Wilson? He was in Raising Arizona. He was Raising Arizona, you know, unfinished furniture guy.
Yeah, and he's great.
And he was also Sam Phillips in Great Balls
of
Fire.
Right, that's right, that's right.
We were all at the University of Houston, and he had a stand-up, Quaden Wilson.
They were in a team?
Incredible, yeah, and they came out here, and they would be at the Comedy Store when they first came out here.
Really?
Yeah, this is back in the early 70s.
Right when the Comedy Store was in its heyday.
I guess so.
And that's how he got in.
Yeah.
Was doing stand-up.
Yeah, and he had a little apartment right behind the Comedy Store over there on Sunset.
I had no idea that Randy Quaid was a comic.
Yeah, but he didn't come here for that.
But he did.
Yeah. They came through Texas when they did Last Picture Show, casting, because they wanted local casting for the Peter Bogdanovich, you know, authenticity and the accents and everything. And they went to the colleges, and Randy was at the University of Houston, and
he was doing the acting thing?
In the acting program.
No, I remember the part. He played the sort of dorky rich kid.
Yeah, I did it last Easter.
Yeah.
And then Bogdanovich called him up a year later and said, come out here and do this little role with Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neal in What's Up, Doc? And that was his, you know, ticket out to L.A.
And you
just
stayed. And you were just starting college
I was still in high school.
When he got those roles.
Yeah.
How's he doing, by the way?
He's doing all right.
Yeah?
He's doing fine. He's doing okay.
Okay.
I'd like to see him work.
Yeah.
That's what I'd like to see him come back and do some more work. And I think a lot of other people would, too. He's a great actor. He's one of my five favorite actors.
He cracked me up all the time growing up. No, he's always been great. And the Last Detail is one of the great movies.
Incredible.
He's great in that.
Yeah.
Well, as long as he's okay.
But.
So you saw he had success with it, and then you just decided to follow suit, or you were already heading that way?
Well, I was kind of torn between music and acting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was in the high school, and I wasn't really in the drama department. It's a rite of passage to go out for the football team in Texas.
And you were too small?
And I was I was kind of lad. I weighed like 130 pounds.
You seem pretty athletic now.
Well, now, I played a lot of football players, baseball players. No,
that's how you got in shape?
Yeah. So, but I definitely wasn't going to make it. So that's how I wound up in the drama room with all the girls.
And was that the last time, in terms of continuing to study? Because I was talking to my producer about this. There's not a lot of guys like you who are around anymore who can do sort of anything, you know, as an actor. Like, you know, you're your own thing, but your range is insanely broad. Yeah.
Well, I think you also got to give, you know, the younger guys time to, you know, age, mature, and grow up and get experience. You know, it just comes through experience. I never had any strategy in my career except to try as many different types of things as possible.
But in terms of training, did you continue to work on that stuff? I mean,
I was at the University of Houston, there was this great acting teacher, which was the reason I was there. And my brother was there too, and Trey and a lot of people, because of Mr. Pickett.
Yeah.
And he taught acting as a craft. Uh-huh. And I was torn between music and acting. And you know, I saw my brother's success, which made it real that you can actually get jobs out here. It wasn't some faraway world, Hollywood, in my mind was. And I wasn't serious in high school, but then when I got into Mr. Pickett's class, within the first week, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. And it's a real gift for an 18, 19-year-old kid.
And that what was so inspirational about that guy?
Because he taught acting as a craft. And, you know, I was very much into human behavior and psychology. And that's really what acting is. And he sort of made that apparent by being observant of people, of creating a character sort of from the outside in.
Yeah.
And the outside will tell you what's going on with that person on the inside.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
For
That's just one of the things. But, you know, it wasn't like a method class. He wasn't like that.
Sort of the opposite of the method
and
almost.
And he had, constructive criticism. He could be brutal. But he taught it as a craft, and it gave you a space to really learn and fail. That's really the space to fail, rather than being out here getting jobs and failing
right.
on camera.
Right.
You know, you get to fail in a class doing a scene, and then come and then work on it, and come back and do it again, and you learn by trial and error, and
you work from experience. Like, you work from the outside. So has that stayed with you, that kind of outside in? Because, like, I believe that's true, that if it's on the page, you know, and you do what's on the page, you'll find who you're supposed to be, right?
Yeah. Well, that was another thing that he taught is, you know, it's what does the playwright say
yeah.
about the character? What
right.
does the character say about himself? What do other people say about the character? You know, what are his actions
uh-huh.
and his motivations, basically.
Yeah. You know?
And how does that fit into the spine of the play or the story that you're thinking about? So
right.
I always thought sort of like mythically.
Right.
And every role I've taken, you know, no matter how silly the part is.
Yeah.
And it's become, over the years, I mean, I used to write everything down, but over the years, it's become more like osmosis.
What did you
kind of seeps in there.
What did you write down?
I would write all that stuff down.
Like a backstory?
And, you know, a whole history and stuff like that. Now it's just something I just kind of, I don't know, it's become so much a part of me that it's, like I said, it's just like osmosis. I just find myself doing it. And I let go a lot more
uh-huh.
than I used to.
Well, this role, I don't know that I've seen you in The Intruder, the new movie. Like, I don't think I've seen you be this horrifying.
that part was just letting go, to tell you the truth.
Of course.
I may have had about two or three people that I've met in life. I may have had them sort of in my mind.
Yeah.
But it's still me back there actually having a nice laugh, to tell you the truth.
Sure, but I mean, wrong? Isn't this the most evil fuck that you've, like, just...
yeah, I would guess so.
Like a psychopath.
I'm usually the warm and fuzzy guy.
Well, no, you've played some slimy dudes.
Yeah, I know, but...
you know, but this guy's straight up psychotic.
Who was that?
who was one of the more slimy characters you played?
In Traffic.
The lawyer
yeah,
in Traffic.
Yeah, the lawyer in Traffic.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
he wasn't necessarily a villain.
He was basically just a slimy lawyer.
A bag man, really.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
right. A morally yeah. compromised
yeah.
fella.
Yeah.
But this guy in The Intruder is like menacing and horrible.
Yeah.
Like, what was that fucking thing you were doing with your teeth? I don't want to spoil anything, but, like, you know, what was that? There's a moment where you're on the bed and you're just kind of looking at your teeth
he was just obsessed. He's OCD.
No, OCD and it, like
the, OCD
and,
is
and
the,
psychotic.
That had to do with really kind of making sure everything was just freshly clean, even though he lived in filth.
Yeah, but so that was just an impulse you had.
Yeah, just
to check your teeth.
They just needed some stuff. They just shoot him here and, you know, in his space, and it wasn't even scripted, so we just
right.
kind of like. Made it up as we went along.
Well, I noticed it, and it was creepy.
They don't show up, but I actually had my hair like in a Hitler haircut.
Oh, really? They didn't want to go overboard?
It was a few things they wanted to pull back from. And because, you know, I have this tendency, I'll go out there and just go big, because it's much easier to pull back than it is to add, is what I kind of think. And so I would have... actors don't really know what's too much sometimes. That's what a director's for.
Right.
And Dion's such a great director. You know, and I asked him at the beginning, please pull me back if you see me going a little too far with this, because it's easy with this part.
Right, because you got a lot of leeway.
Yeah.
You're a psychopath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can do anything you want.
Yeah.
You're the 800-pound gorilla.
So, like, going back, though, what were the first movies? For you, like before Breaking Away, there was a few?
Before Breaking Away, I came out here and I spent...
So right after college, you come out here.
Yeah, I come out here. I didn't even finish college. I went 2.5 years there because I was going to be an actor. That's
and
the reason I went.
And you got enough? You were like,
yeah,
I get it.
Degree
I get it.
Was not really going to do me much good out there in Hollywood.
It didn't matter?
Yeah.
But you felt like you learned enough?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was time for me to go, so I came out and sent my picture to every agent in town. I got turned down, and so I started calling up casting directors.
Were you living with your brother?
I was on his couch for about the first couple of months. In fact, then my very first movie set I was on, Randy was doing Missouri Breaks, Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson.
I remember that. You know why you just woke up? Because I cut your throat.
Yeah. That was my first set. I was on watching Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson.
It's a pretty good movie. Like, Brando is like out there, man. When he's dressed up with the old lady on that horse. Come on, man.
Nothing to do with the script.
I know.
It was just all out of the fuck. And I would go to Dailies every day and watch Marlon Brando. They do 10 takes of a scene, and he would do it 10 different ways.
I'm trying to remember. Your brother was one of the guys he was chasing. He was in the crew.
He had an excellent scene. He had a great couple of scenes, especially, you know, at the campfire before Marlon kills him.
Right. Yeah. So that's how you got introduced.
Yeah, and then, you know, I got an agent after about a year. I was calling up casting directors, and, you know, just out of Variety, where it said films in the future, and I would just go in and ask for an interview just because I, you know, because they're the ones that cast the film. And then 9 out of 10 would say no, 1 would say yes, and so I'd go in. And I would look at my shoes for the first couple of interviews because I learned how to do interviews that way.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And after about 9 months of that, one of them called up one of those agents that had turned me down, and I got an agent. And then about 2 months later, I got a job.
Did you meet Brando?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually taught Brando a couple of chords on the mandolin he had to do a scene where he's playing mandolin.
I kind of remember
that.
I
play guitar. Right. And they said, Marlon's got to learn to play mandolin. Anybody here play mandolin? I just went, oh, I do. I play mandolin.
Sure.
Like the wind. Of course I play it. I didn't play mandolin.
But is it just
I did not play mandolin.
Is it same tuning?
No, it's different. It's different tuning. And so I, you know, I just went to the music store and got like a chord book and learned the 3 chords that were in that song, you know, and, got to spend an hour in his trailer with him.
Oh, how was that?
That was like, you know, a big thrill of my life. I could barely talk. Yeah. Let's just put it that way.
Was it weird?
Well, as far as being starstruck, you know,
sure.
These days, you know, I definitely don't get starstruck over too many people. But
right.
He was my idol, icon, you know.
And it was before he went totally loopy, right?
He never went totally loopy.
No?
No, he never did. He may have seemed that way to the outside of the world, but he was not. He was a brilliant, he was a genius. Yes. And he was also just a very sweet man, too.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, you know, I get to spend an hour in his trailer with him, you know?
Yeah.
And
did you talk about anything?
I hardly remember what we talked about. I could hardly put a sentence together.
But you're showing a mandolin, too.
Yeah, I'm showing a mandolin. So at least I had something to, like, something real to kind of hold on to.
I guess that's a good point, though, about what people in the world know about somebody and what people, you know, like, you know, it is sort of strange, the assumptions we make. He was an odd guy, you know, who, you know, was gifted and got old and got, you know, sort of like he seemed strange to.
And you know, there was a certain kind of alienation from the business for him, because that was back in the day. He sort of invented the idea that you don't go to award shows.
Right, right.
And, he turned out that it had, you know, what was her name that accepted the Academy Award for him. And so that put him in the kind of sort of oddball category for a lot of people.
A Native American
and
woman.
And then Mutiny on the Bounty he was in Hollywood jail for quite a few years, for about 12 years, because that movie had gone so over budget. And they pinned it on him. You know, and every other actor idolized him because he basically invented modern acting.
I know. Which movie was it for you that kind of like made you like, oh,
Brandon? A Streetcar Named Desire.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And on the waterfront, like, you know.
Incredible.
So you get to, so you're out here like a year and you're showing Brando how to play mandolin. That's exciting.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's enough for a lot of people.
And then what was then
I got my first movie was called 9/30/55, The Date.
Yeah.
And it's the date that James Dean died, and its effect that it had on these 7 college kids in Arkansas. And it was, James Bridges was the director. I think he did Paper Chase, brought him in the China Syndrome, you might remember him from. But a great director, and he was from Arkansas. So it was kind of basically his story.
Yeah.
I remember the first time the camera came in on me, it was really quite intimidating. you know, and they had big cameras back then, and right. You had to have those big cameras. Huge lights.
Yeah.
So like right before my first take, one of those big Klieg lights, you know, that are about as powerful as the sun.
Yeah.
If you know, in the wind, it just falls over about 4 feet from me. So,
and you're already freaked
out. You're kind of spooked, you know, yeah. like a dog that's been kicked. You got to give one.
Yeah.
And, but that was a great way to start because Jim was, you know, he was very protective of everybody and, you know, was bringing, because all the actors, it was our first movie, Dennis Christopher's first movie.
How'd it come out? Because, like, I don't know that movie. I feel like I should know.
It kind of came and went at the time. It was a very personal story. It was, you know, a movie of the 70s.
Right.
So there was, you know.
And you were what, 20?
It was kind of dark, too, you know. And I was 21.
77.
21,
yeah. And then and that led to Breaking Away.
23? I was 23. Oh my God. Yeah, okay. That 9 months, got another job, you know, kind of like drive in movies. I did a couple of those and AIG, you know, and then Breaking Away came along and that really changed my life and my career.
And you were you playing a teenager?
Yes, 25? I was playing teenagers up till I was 27. Up until I played Gordo Cooper, I was still playing teenagers.
Well, Breaking Away was like a huge movie because it was one of those movies where, you know, as a kid, you'd go see it.
Right.
And it was
such a surprise, too. It's basically, I think, you know, they had those kind of what turned out to be the Brat Pack in the 80s.
Right.
Youth movies, you know.
Yeah.
I think Breaking Away was really the first of those.
Yeah, because it was you and Stern, Daniel Stern.
Danny Stern, Jackie Earle Haley.
He disappeared for a while, and then he came back.
Yeah, Danny, he was fantastic.
Wow, man.
I was so proud of him for that.
I mean, he was out for a while, right?
Yeah.
Do you guys talk?
We had a reunion about 3 years ago.
The Breaking Away
reunion? It was
really
cool. It was like the 30-year reunion. And, you know, Dennis Christopher still has the bicycle from there. And,
no kidding.
And we got together. And it was.
I haven't seen really him good. In much like I've, lately.
Dennis and I have stayed in touch through the years.
He played the guy who was obsessed with the Italians.
Right.
And Daniel was Daniel.
Right.
You know what's weird is I can't really
Danny
remember.
Stern.
Yeah. I can't remember the other team at all. I can't remember the jockey guys. I know you guys were sort of the you know, the working class, the long shot.
Right. We were the locals.
Right, the locals.
We were.
Right.
And I don't remember. You and, you know, and we felt like strangers in our own hometown.
Right.
Basically, we're treated like that. Right.
Oh, and I remember there's that scene where you're swimming in the quarry and you hit your head and it's so horrible.
Yeah.
So,
and that quarry, actually, that we were at, that was the quarry that they built the Empire State Building from.
Really?
That very quarry, yeah.
I just know when I went to look at that college, which I did after I got out of high school, I was like, this is where they did that movie.
Yeah, and it was like 100 feet deep down there.
I know, I went and saw the quarry.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them out there.
Right.
And they built the school out of that, too, that whole Bloomington.
Right.
So that's where it starts. So then all of a sudden.
And also, Peter Yates basically taught the four of us film acting. He taught me how to be, you know, that wasn't a stage. You know, the camera's in close, and it will read your mind. You don't really have to do anything.
Don't overdo it.
Well, you always have a tendency to want to, like,
act.
You think other people can't see it.
Right.
And also, when you see yourself on film, especially for the first time, you can't tell anything.
Yeah.
You know? You don't see anything.
Right.
But he was, you know, I'd been cast for a reason because I looked and sounded like the guy he wanted to, you know, the character, in other words. And so. He taught me how to be small.
You were the troublemaker kind of guy.
I was the guy that, you know, who's like probably the most pissed off.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, my days of glory had come and gone. High school
football. Right, that's right. Yeah,
mean old man Mike.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah. But it was such, and then when it came out, I remember driving to the theater and my brother was in the front seat driving us there and he goes, looks like he got a hit because the line was around the block. That was back in the days when they'd have lines around the block.
Sure.
And people would just show up. You know, it was kind of mysterious.
Yeah.
You know, people would show up. Yeah, as far as openings, you know, like audience could smell movies back then, you know, and I think they still can, to tell you the truth.
Well, it's weird. I just talked to Irwin Winkler like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
about the right stuff specifically, mm-hmm. and about like the sort of jarring experience that you know everything leading into that movie and everything about that movie, it should have been a huge movie.
Yes, it should have. It was a dud at the box office. Yeah, it was made $2 million,
and
which is a penance, you know, for opening weekend.
He couldn't figure it out.
Oh, I know exactly why.
You do?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons why.
Was it something competing?
It was an election year.
Uh huh.
John Glenn was running for president. John Glenn, none of the astronauts had anything to do with the movie.
They wouldn't get behind it?
No, they wouldn't get behind it.
Yeah.
And just like they wouldn't get behind the novel. And I know why, because of Gus Grissom. The way Gus Grissom is, Tom Wolfe turned him into a literary device, you know, because they had this whole thing about the top of the pyramid.
Right.
And Gus, you know, he went up there, would had dimes in his pocket, you know, like he's
that's
you know,
real,
you know,
right?
Like souvenirs.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Stuff. Yes, he did. But everybody else did too. Okay.
Okay.
But to make a thing of it, but it was about the hatch. He was in the second flight.
Yeah.
He, when he landed, the hatch just blew.
Right.
Right. That was, and they lost the spacecraft. It went to the bottom, and he did not get the parade that.
That's all true.
Shepard did.
All true.
This is all true, and not even to go to the White House with it. So he
was disgraced in a way.
That's what Wolf would have you think, but that is not the truth.
Okay.
For one thing, that was the first time that they had ever had a hatch on a spacecraft. Before that, they were just bolted in, and the astronauts had all insisted that they have an escape hatch that they could blow with explosives.
Yeah.
And had a window.
Yeah.
And also a window in it. So because they were pilots.
I guess.
And
yeah.
They wanted control of it.
Right.
This one had some. So they sent it up and on its flight, but they had not taken into account the pressurization effects on those
hatches.
Explosive bolts.
Coming
so when he hit
in.
The water yeah. and the effect of splashdown hit the water and the thing just did blow because of it wasn't designed right. And he almost drowned. His, you know, suit filled with water.
Right.
He was about 3 seconds away from actually going 1,000 feet down, just like a spacecraft.
Right.
Because it was going to be dead weight. And he was saved. And if he was so disgraced, if he was such had blown it so much, then why did they give him the first Gemini flight? And why did they give him the first Apollo flight where he was killed there on the launch pad? But I think he would have been the first man on the moon, to tell you the truth, because he was the best pilot that they had.
Uh-huh.
He was very calm and cool. He had an engineer's mind, and he was the one that was really most of all complaining about, because it was such a hurried process getting to the moon.
Yeah,
that they skipped a lot of quality control getting there.
Sure,
and. He was the one that was complaining about it the most. In fact, he was complaining about the wiring that they had in front of them in an oxygen-rich environment. And sure enough, they wound up. That's how they got killed.
So basically, the Brotherhood of Astronauts were like, "Fuck this movie."
Well, I would say it wouldn't be so much "fuck this movie," but Gordo Cooper, I was lucky. Because it just so happened, because I'd read the book. I grew up in Houston, which is Space City.
Yeah.
Gordo Cooper was my favorite astronaut as a kid. I was right in the pocket of that age where they rolled in the TV and you saw him going into space. They were replaced wanting to be a cowboy or anything else.
Yeah.
And Gordo Cooper was my favorite astronaut of the original seven because he was the youngest. It was sort of like a rock and roll astronaut.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
I really liked that name, Gordo.
Yeah, yeah, great.
And then I wound up, the book came out and it said, if they ever do a movie this, I'd give anything to play him.
Yeah.
And then I went in to audition for it, and what do you know? We got it.
Yeah.
It was like the dream of a lifetime. And then guess what? It's like they discouraged everybody from contacting their astronauts, or whatever.
Why?
But, I guess either liability or suit or NASA wasn't behind it and
right.
all the rest from the get-go because they weren't. NASA wasn't behind. It didn't really like the way Tom Wolfe had betrayed everybody as well.
Right.
Tom Wolfe was trying to create a novel with things. And so he needed literary devices with this whole theme of the top of the pyramid. But turned out Gordo Cooper lived 3 miles from me in L.A.
Come on.
Over the valley.
Yeah.
So I called him up.
Yeah.
And he said, come on over. And he was the most generous, wonderful dude. And he's from him, I learned to fly. Because I was telling him, you know, I should learn that radio voice you guys got. You know, I'd like to learn to fly. He said, well, yeah, I'll learn to fly. So he sent me over to Bud Wallen Aviation there in Van Nuys. And I got my pilot's license while we were doing the film on the sly. Uh-huh. And I got...
You still fly?
Yeah, I fly jets.
Yeah?
Fly Citation jets, though. I kept that up after, you know, that after we were there.
That must be fun.
Yeah, well, it's darn convenient.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. But...
You have a plane?
I've had three. Then I had a Bonanza single engine, which I really miss. But it just got to be... I would fly 400 hours a year, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And for different reasons. But it just got to be I was working so much and, you know, this and that, that I... You know, that dwindled down to like 90 hours, and it, you know, costs
not
more to keep
it.
Your
right,
plane
sure,
in a hangar
sure.
than it does to, you know, to fly.
So hanging kind of, out with Gordo, did so you got a real good sense of that guy.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. I, you know, flew with Jaeger in a Bonanza over the lake bed where, you know, used to, where Poncho's was, and got it there at the Edwards Air Force Base. Just, he was on the set every day. It was like having John Wayne.
I bet.
Said every
well, I love, that's my favorite moment, really, oddly, of that movie, is your moment on the press conference where you know, when they ask
who's the best pilot you ever
and
saw.
And you have that moment where you, like, you're thinking of Jaeger, right?
Yeah.
And then
right.
you're looking at him.
Right.
But, like, that beat, I love
right.
that beat.
Yeah, he's going to give it away.
The and unsung
he
hero.
Well, yeah, it was the guy that couldn't make it because he didn't have a college degree, number one. They were looking yeah. for college degrees and, you know... Jaeger was the best pilot,
and Shepard was so good. Everybody
was
so,
really
everybody
good.
Everybody was so
he
fucking.
He and Jaeger like yeah. hung out like every day. They'd be over there. You'd look over, and you know they had the hood of Sam's truck open, and you know going over the engine because Sam doesn't fly. He was afraid to fly. He had a thing. I guess he'd had a bad experience, but he didn't fly. He drove everywhere.
Really?
Yeah.
So he had his truck.
Yeah,
and
they'd be over there, and you know that's. Jaeger was from, you know, West Virginia, you know, basically started out repairing lawnmowers. That's how he learned about engines. And so, he, you know, they loved engines.
So they just
thought... They'd be over there talking engines all day long.
I was always...
And Levon Helm, too, you know.
Who oh, yeah,
was,
he's
like,
great.
His,
got a stick of Beamans?
Yeah, a stick of Beamans. I might have me a stick.
It's great. I think that was the first time he acted, too, I think.
The first, well, the coal miner's daughter.
Oh, that's right. Was that after or before?
No, that was before.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I don't know.
It's kind of mixed up in my memory now a little bit.
But I love that movie, and I thought the script was great, and I thought the comedic elements were great, because there are, like, the thing that's great about that movie is it's a great heroic story,
yeah.
but there's a lot of comedy in it.
Yeah, man. And it's become a classic since then, but the original thing was... Why did it fail at the box office?
Right.
And, so John Glenn was running for president at the time, and I think that had a lot to do with they were. And then Walter Cronkite actually did an interview right around the time that it was coming out.
Yeah.
And you know he was with the astronauts and with NASA and all that, and the way they portrayed the astronauts was as Boy Scouts. Basically, they could do no wrong, and you know they were. They were human beings, you know,
yep.
who were out there, you know, doing things we probably should, we wouldn't want our wives or,
right.
You
sure.
know, sometimes friends to know. And that was, you know, the press went along with it. Back then, you didn't have paparazzi out
right.
there. You're following your every move, one to
sure.
out you. You
know, and they like were
they
managing
Kennedy.
The,
yeah. and,
managing the image, too.
Yeah. And yeah. they, you know, everybody's supporting. And Walter Cronkite, you know, these guys were heroes that had put their life on the line. They weren't used to being celebrities. Or,
yeah.
And, so, Walter Cronkite dissed the movie based on that, and
it showed too much of their humanity in a way, like the too much behind the scenes.
Yeah, I guess he thought it was a little too one sided about you know the sort of extracurricular thing,
uh-huh.
and also the way, but really basically the way it had treated Gus Grissom,
mm-hmm.
and
that
you know
I
agreed
on
I it? Agreed with that. To tell you the truth
yeah.
about the way they had because that's what people will remember
yeah.
and he you know he gave his life
right
really for he gave his life you
yeah.
know they went in there knowing that they basically had about a 50% chance of dying
yeah
every time they went up
yeah That's interesting. Because, like, I don't know. I don't know that Erwin Winkler considered any of this, you know,
well,
really.
Well, no, they probably did because they saw it from, you know, it's just another movie. And you can't blame them. They're out to turn a book into a film.
Right.
And it was a perfect timing for the film, I thought, too. Yeah, it was right there sort of when it came out at the beginnings of the Reagan administration. And
the right time for it to succeed. You
yeah,
mean.
And I think actually one of the towards the end of shooting, I think that's when one of the shuttles blew up.
Was it that early?
Yeah.
Huh.
But I went down to, I remember going down to NASA for that. It was just, the research was great. You got to go on all those doors that say authorized personnel.
Well, they let you in there though, but they weren't supportive of the movie, but they still let you go down there and.
Oh yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, there was, you know.
We didn't talk about the Long Riders, which I was fucking excited about. I remember because I was in high school still and it was like all the brothers.
Yeah.
And it's fucking Walter Hill.
That, yeah.
It's like you and your brother. Mm-hmm. And is there a third Quaid?
Well, we have a half brother. His name is Buddy.
Was he in it?
No, he was. He was just born. It was
the Carradines. Oh, the Keeches and the Carradines.
Two Quaids. Yeah, the Keeches.
Yeah.
Two, and then the Carradine brothers. So three Carradine brothers.
Right.
Chris Guest
had a brother.
Chris Guest, you know,
yeah,
Chris
sure,
Guest.
Sure. Yeah.
And his brother.
I just love the whole idea of it. I remember being a pretty good movie.
It was a really good movie. Walter Hill directed it. And, you know, it was about the James gang.
Yeah.
And that was one of the last of the great ones of that particular era.
Sure.
You know, when Westerns were going out of style. You still see some good ones every once in a while.
Yeah, I just read a book there's a new book about the Wild Bunch, about the making of the Wild Bunch, and about Peckinpah and that whole trip down there. It just was crazy, man.
Yeah.
Just going down to Mexico and just, you know, camping out and like, dude, the kind of risks they took and like just how insane it was.
Oh, yeah.
And like, you know, most of the guys he had on, he was tapped into that whole crew of stunt dudes and, you know, wackos.
Right.
And
they'd do anything and they'd come in, you know, after a hard night.
Oh, yeah. And they just
Sam, just to recover, would say, go build some track. Go build some track for a tracking shot. He knew that would take at least an hour and a half so he could
get himself together.
Right?
Yeah. Did you ever meet that guy?
I actually owned Sam Peckinpah and Warren Oates owned a piece of property in Montana.
Yeah.
And Warren and I did Tough Enough together, and we became good friends. And I owned a little piece of property in Montana at that time, but then. And Warren and I, he became kind of like, you know, kind of fatherly in a way. You know?
Yeah.
And he had a heart attack at age of 51 and died with his boots on. I bought his half of the place with Peckinpah.
Huh.
And then Peckinpah died about 10 years later, and I bought his half from the kid. So I had their place in Peckinpah's cabin. Warren was down at the bottom, and it actually had plumbing and stuff, and beautiful place. And then Sam was up 3 miles up in the mountains, no running water, no plumbing, no, you know, electricity, you know, he got everything out of the creek, and he had his bookcase up there. He built the bed, and the table, big, huge, wonderfully made crap, such craftsmanship.
Sure.
There's not a nail in it. It was all pegged.
Oh, wow.
And then this bookcase was there, and there was a 1972 Playboy magazine. There was the Holy Bible, and I opened up the Holy Bible, and there's a couple of Polaroids in there of, you know, some of the stunt guys and Warren, and then there's a picture of Sam in his long johns on the side of a house, and he's got his holster on. You know, and so he's got, you know, he's got his gun in there, and great. And then there's the holster sitting right there, and then there was a mason jar full of moonshine.
Uh huh. That's the way he lived in Montana.
Yeah,
that was his vacation house.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's nice you got an opportunity to spend time with those guys.
Yeah. Well, I never met Sam.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I never did, because every time I would go up there, he would be in town, I guess, at the Murray Hotel. He liked to play poker.
Uh-huh.
And,
real character.
Warren and I were great friends. I had that place for 25 years and just recently sold it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I love those. I used to do like a Peckinpah Film Fest every year and just go through,
oh,
you know, all the way from, you know, Ride the High Country
right
up, you know.
Beautiful movie,
all
the way that through. One.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, they're really wild. They're yeah really trippy, fucked up man movies.
Bring Me to the Head of Alfredo
that
Garcia.
That movie is so fucked up, dude.
Yeah, that's Warren Oates' favorite
where
movie.
Where he's just talking to the head.
Mm-hmm.
He's driving with that wrapped head.
Right.
And he's talking
yeah
to it.
But my favorite is The Wild Bunch.
Oh,
it was
great.
Just, you know, it was a, as far as that era of the 60s, early 70s, and, you know, that movie along with Bonnie and Clyde of, you know,
yeah,
really ultra violence that was in that film. It was, you know, as art, and
it doesn't even compare
that
now.
Was
it's so weird.
Real
that
Western, man.
It was, but it's so risque. You know, it was risque at the time, but now you look at what's happening, and it's
right
like it's nothing.
Yeah,
you know,
what we see on television every day. You know,
and reading the book about it, I didn't really take into consideration a lot of the kind of like these were guys in a transition period mm-hmm in the West, like
right
they were old timers.
Right.
You know, trying to adapt.
Well, yeah, you see a car. You know, yeah, he always put it yeah like an automobile in a lot of his movies.
Well, that,
you know,
the Ballad,
because it was, and that was sort of like about the end of the,
exactly,
and the beginning of something else.
It's
you
like
know
the Ballad of Cable Hogue with
yeah
the Robards. That's all about a car showing
yeah
up, I
right
think. There's a scene where it's like,
yeah,
oh,
it's about
over
the end of their world. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, trippy, man. I don't know why I keep saying trippy, but it's like, it's deep stuff. It's deeper.
Because yeah it's trippy, man.
Yeah, man. Well, then, okay, I'm just going to pick and choose a couple because we're kind of moving through it. But I remember The Big Easy because you put on the full drawl.
Yeah.
You really kind of locked into the accent.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't call it a drawl, but
no.
That was a blend between a Cajun, like a, you know, patois type
yeah
of accent and and a you know, a, what they call a yat, New Orleans yat,
right,
which
right
is sort of, you know, like close to like a Brooklyn type
yeah
of thing,
oh, right,
you know, where they talk down
yeah
there. And so you put them together, and you know, it kind of comes out like that. And I met four people that were like that that had that accent in New Orleans.
And
it's
that's
not
how
it's not very common, but that yeah, I met four people. Who
and that's
that
where you pulled it from.
I just kind of put them together, yeah,
yeah,
and just came out with that one.
That was I'm kind of fascinated with the kind of darkness of New Orleans, I guess, like
yeah
a lot of people are, and I thought that was a manageable way to move through it.
Yeah, it was, you know, had a lot of charm, that
yeah
movie to it, and you know, that's Tennessee Williams kind of like describe it. You know, has had a raffish charm with but there was always a latent violence.
Right,
that would be.
Well, there's a darkness there. There's definitely sort of
yeah
a something. There's something about the swamp and about the weird kind of a mix of peoples
mm-hmm
and how they've evolved.
It's a gumbo, you
yeah
know?
Yeah.
And that's where the Quakes actually came from, you know, because they were in Canada and they, you know, came down in there and they're back up in the swamps of Louisiana because just to be able to get away, and, you know, and they were French speaking.
Yeah.
And there were Native Americans up there and it all mixed together.
Right.
And also Spanish,
right,
who were, you know, leftover Spanish. And in fact, up until the 1930s,
yeah,
your first language, if you were born there, was French. It wasn't Huey P. Long, when he became governor of Louisiana, built the bridges over the bayous. And
yeah
so basically, they were secluded from the rest of the world up until then.
Right, and I think that's what's interesting is these kind of people that kind of, you know, different types of people that kind of became one people.
Right.
It only happened, it didn't happen in a lot of places, but it sort of happened there.
Yeah, it's really kind of more of what America is supposed to
for
be
sure
like than in any other region.
Yeah,
you
yeah
know, well, you had black, white,
yeah,
you know, Native American, and Mexican, and just everything.
So you've got some Native American in your family?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You tracked that back?
Yes, I tracked it back. My grandfather, and then, you know, back to that. They actually, the Quades deduced, they left Louisiana for Oklahoma, I think, to escape the Civil War or to, you know, some draft thing. It's kind of, who knows?
Yeah.
They really, it wasn't their fight,
yeah,
I think. So that's how they wound up in Oklahoma.
not going to die for this one.
No.
And then you, oh, that's right, you played Doc Holliday.
Yeah. That was, gosh, I love that guy. He was one of my favorite characters I ever played.
Yeah, that was good. That was
one of
good.
The most difficult, I think.
And that was with, with Costner's Wyatt Earp.
Yes.
Did he direct it?
Maybe kind of half, you know, all the stuff that was, shooting Buffalo and everything.
But, oh, Kasdan directed that. I didn't even know that.
Was, yeah.
He tried the Western twice.
Yes, well, Silverado. Yeah. And Wyatt Earp.
I think he tried to pack too much into Silverado.
I think he tried to pack too much into Wyatt Earp, to tell you the truth.
Oh, both,
I mean,
huh?
Yeah, I kind of felt like it was too long.
Yeah.
And it was also being made at the same time as Tombstone.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think is actually the more accessible movie.
It's a shorter movie.
Well, it actually tells the story and, you know, tells it succinctly.
That's Kurt Russell.
Yeah, Kurt Russell.
Yeah, you guys are like, you guys are two of like.
I was actually offered that one too.
To do Doc?
I was offered Tombstone and
for Doc Holliday on both?
Yes.
What did you think of Val's version?
I thought Val was very good.
What was his little tag?
You're my Huckleberry.
Huckleberry.
You're my Huckleberry.
Yeah. He really went over the top with it.
I really liked his performance, you know. And then he could just get mean. He really had that right about Doc. I mean, I learned everything about Doc. I really kind of fell in love with the guy.
Yeah.
Because he was one of those guys, you know, he had tuberculosis and, you know, he was going to die. That's the reason he was out west. You
yeah.
know, he was a dentist and the reason he was out west because it's the only place he could breathe.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And he knew he was going to die. So in a gunfight,
mm-hmm.
he could stand there and be calm.
Mm-hmm.
And aim and fire, and that, you know, because that's usually what won the day, not being fast.
Oh, because he didn't care.
Guys pull guns and they just
freak out.
Scared, you know, you're scared shitless, and you're just, you know, you're shooting everything. And it's the guy who could keep his head and aim who would.
And he could keep his head because he knew he was going to die.
He was
going to
die anyway. What he didn't care.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And
doing him a favor.
The rookie, you're the baseball player. You learn to play ball.
Yeah, Jimmy Morris was on the set for all of that too, which I really appreciated. And thank God he was left-handed. And great story, and which sort of reflected my own life at the time.
Yeah.
Which because the movie's about second chances,
right?
And that movie was really got the ball really rolling for me. I mean, start with the '90s. I was, you know, kind of. My career was kind of going through a valley. Let's put it.
Was it?
Parent Trap sort of started a new thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but then The Rookie really cemented that, and it also came out back to back performance in Far From Heaven.
Yeah.
Oh,
that
was
you
year.
Were great in that. I mean, that's the thing. It's like so vastly...
a closet gay guy and a major league pitcher.
But you approach everything the same way, you know,
yeah.
in terms as an actor. You know,
yeah.
you kind of like.
Human behavior is always been very interested in about what makes people tick.
Yeah.
Why are they the way they are?
And do you, I guess you answer it with each character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would I do if I were that character?
Yeah.
You know, and you sort of live in their shoes and their skin, but it's always you.
Yeah.
You can never get away from playing yourself because you always are playing yourself.
That's
it's just
true,
that
right?
We all have everything that every other person has, all the same emotions,
sure.
all potentially the same reactions to those emotions, or, you know, these cliches about life because they're true. And but you're always playing yourself.
Yeah, right. I guess that's true. I've been doing some acting myself, and I'm always sort of wondering about that. But you're going to do some version of, you're it's always.
Yeah, you don't go to see, like, you know, Vito Corleone or whatever. You know, it's Marlon Brando. Everybody knows that's Marlon Brando. Like, oh, he disappeared into the character.
But some people do.
No, yeah, but Marlon Brando just is doing a great job of that character.
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
true. But some people seem to go through a tremendous amount of process in order to get places, you know.
Yes.
But
and, you know, that's part of, like, learning acting. And, you know, there's still, like, I know actors that are still like that. Bill Hurt is very studied, and everybody has their own.
But he's
a particular method. That's the method. Everybody has their own way of doing things.
Right, but the funny thing about Hurt is no, there's no more a person that's more painfully Bill Hurt than Bill Hurt.
Yes.
Like I don't
yes,
know, whatever,
exactly.
Whatever he's doing, he's always going to be like, you know, he's got that intensity, the pacing.
He's going to take it, like a simple question, he's going to take to some place.
Have you worked with him?
Oh, yeah, I've worked with him twice. I just worked with him, in fact. I love the guy. Yeah. I really totally love the guy. I love his point of view of life.
Uh-huh.
And I love his quirks.
Yeah. Right?
You know, he's a brilliant actor.
Yeah.
And he just feels so deeply about everything.
That's good.
And, you know, very sensitive human being.
And what was it like working with, like, on that that crazy Oliver Stone movie?
With Oliver or with everybody? Knowing Oliver's reputation,
quarterback. Were you?
Yeah, I played a quarterback.
That's right.
Cap Rooney.
Yeah,
and you know, the Jamie Foxx is the up and comer.
Right.
You know?
That's right. I like that movie.
It was great. I think it's the best football movie ever done. To tell you the truth,
it
because it's so visceral.
Yeah.
You really feel.
Yeah.
What it's like to be in the game.
Yeah.
You know, I thought Oliver Stone, you know, given his reputation, which was just a reputation in a lot of ways.
Right.
That you know. A lot of people were going to get hurt doing that film.
Yeah.
And nobody did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody did. He took care of everybody really well, and he made an incredible movie.
Yeah. It's weird that comes up again, this idea that the general public makes judgments of people and you know, based on you know the information they get. But once you're sort of in it and working.
You know that joke. We call him Taco because he makes great tortillas, and we call him this because he does that. And what do they call you? And it was, well... You fuck one goat.
That's right. That's true. You're the goat fucker.
You're the goat fucker.
All right, man. Well, it's really great to talk to you. And there's more to talk about, but I feel like the dog's got to eat.
She's coming down. I guess your contractor's out there. She's barking at something.
But the Todd Haynes thing, I talked to him years ago, too. Todd Haynes, the guy who did...
Far From Heaven. Yeah. Like, brilliant, brilliant guy.
But when you work with somebody like that, who's got, you know, he's a very unique director. He's got a very specific vision for that movie. Mm-hmm. He's making sort of his version of a Douglas Sirk movie.
Yeah.
Like in the process of working with all these different directors, you know, do you find yourself, I mean, what is the experience from director to director? I guess I am
always there as an actor.
Yeah.
This is what I learned early on.
Yeah.
Is the actor is actually there to serve the director.
Right.
Because even though it may have been written by, you know, from a novel by this or whatever, it's still the director is telling the story.
Right.
He's the directing. In fact, that's what it means. He's directing where the camera is, what the camera is looking at to tell the story.
Yeah.
And so I'm there to serve him because I can't be making a different movie than the director.
Yeah.
That won't work.
Right.
You know, and I'll look like an idiot.
Yeah.
So you have to trust your director. And so that's, I've been very, tried to be very good about choosing strong directors.
Mm-hmm.
I like strong directors, in fact, who will take me out of my comfort zone because actors have a general tendency, you know, to either have the same haircut they did the last film, you know, or do the same things that they know will work because that's their money.
Yeah.
You know, like me, it's my smile.
Yeah.
But, a director who will take you out of your comfort zone and make you do things you're not comfortable doing.
That's the best.
That's the best. That's when you are the best, too.
Well, you're right. There is some, you have very specific Dennis Quaid-isms. But but even in this new movie, it's like all those become so malignant and awful. Even the things that like you
know, sort of use it.
Your smile is just
you know,
sort of
basically
like,
the first part of the movie, I'm playing the Parent Trap Dad.
Yeah. And then things go bad.
Then things go bad.
How do you stay in character generally over time? Is it just happen?
I just turn it on and off.
Oh, really?
You know, I kind of first started to learn that with work with Meryl Streep in Postcards from the Edge, and she was just like, you know, the great Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
And she is. But, you know, she would just like, she'd be like goofing off, you know, just talking, blah, 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 blah. You know, we're just like having a good time on some completely different other subject, you know, that has nothing to do with the movie or the appropriate emotion that goes with, you know, the scene that we're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they say rolling and we're still, you know, it's like, okay, action.
Right
into it.
Huh.
Just like that. And then cut right out of it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Not walking around in
it. Yeah, and I tell you what, it's actually easier in the long run to work that way because, number one, you don't take your work home with you.
Right.
Which the last time I did that was Great Balls of Fire, and I wound up in rehab doing that. But and number two, you just drop it like a hot potato, and then so that you can, you can go do what you ever have to do in your life, and you come back, and it'll be fresh. In other words, I actually like it when I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you'll be in the moment.
Yeah.
More that way.
If you're not living it.
Yeah. Like, I don't learn my lines. I may read the script about 10 times, but I don't learn my lines.
Until the day of?
Yeah. Sometimes, most of the time during rehearsal.
Really?
Unless I have a really long
But you know the story and you know the character.
I just listen.
You know
it makes you listen more to what the other character's saying so that, you know the response.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes it more in the moment that way for me, and I don't have to, like, make up something.
Yeah.
I forget. I just kind of, you take all that stuff that you learn as an actor, the technique, and, learning about all those basics.
Sure.
And then you wad them up and throw it away and just let go.
Right. And are you sober guy?
Well, I don't do cocaine anymore.
Good.
That was my drug of choice. And in fact, 1990, I did, 30 days, 28 days in there. And I quit everything for like 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I did what they told me to do.
Yeah.
And, but then I started having a drink about the year 2000.
Yeah.
Alcohol was, I don't like the feeling of being drunk.
Right. And, so you can manage it?
Yeah, it's nothing to manage because I just like that. Yeah, I get a little buzz, but feeling drunk, I feel so sluggish, and I don't like that feeling. Yeah. And
cocaine was crazy. Can you even
cocaine?
Imagine?
I would do until it was all done there, and I'd ask you if you had some when I had plenty in my
pocket.
Been
up for 3 days. Yeah, it's a crazy drug.
Right.
Like, as an older, I'm 55. You're older than me, but like the thought of doing it now is just like, oh my god.
I kind of look back and can't imagine it. Yeah,
you're up for 3 days talking about nothing to nobody.
Yeah, you do like the first snip of it, then spend the next 12 hours trying to get that feeling back
and
again.
You
know,
and
you
then
never
you're just
do.
Up.
Yeah, then you're just up, and you got to be at work in an hour.
The worst.
Not really great.
The worst.
Build some drag.
Yeah. All right, man. Great talking to you.
You too, man.
Thanks
it was
for
really
coming
a
by.
Lot of fun.
Yeah. So that's that. How was that? I love that guy. It's like, it's sometimes I'm in this chair and I'm looking right at a guy I've looked at on screen my whole life and he smiles and I'm like, that's Dennis Quaid sitting right there. I'm going to play some echoey guitar. I'm going to bring some more pedals up here. Apparently, I'm going to be here a while. I will get some more pedals. But I'm just going to do this now. I am the three-chord wonder. Is that all right? Is that a good superhero name? The three-chord wonder? Here he comes with his basic blues power. Here he comes with his basic ability to play three chords in a thoughtful, kind of ethereal way. Look out. Everyone's going to take a pause because I'm the three-chord wonder. I distract them. They're like, is this song going anywhere? I don't think so. Oh no, we've been tied up by the other superheroes. Yep, I did it again. Enjoy. We'll be right back. Boomer lives.